Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. I am here, not with professional vacationer Thea Lena Duzzi, who trolled me on Twitter this week with a poster from Naples, which read, "Say no to pineapple on pizza," in English, suspiciously. So anyway, she said it was from Naples, but she's not here. But token northerner, former indie pop star Lucy Dallas is alongside me. Lucy, hello.
Hello.
Hawaiian pizzas?
I can claim no high ground. I used to love a Hawaiian pizza. I haven't had one for ages, but I used to eat them with relish and gusto.
Yeah, I still eat them regularly. My daughter likes them, so I'm...
There you go. It's fruit. It's one of your five, is it?
Yeah,
I mean, probably not. No.
It's probably particularly sugary fruit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Also, as I said on Twitter, what do Italians really know about pizza?
I really hope you didn't
say that.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I quote tweeted Thea and said that.
Well done.
Well done, me. Anyway, if you're not already, get subscribing to the TLS. Here is a code to enable you to do so. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. That's podcast.the-tls.com. And if you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. And you'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. And remember last week we talked about how our listeners did seem to range across the world and I asked you to tweet your locations. Well, guess what, Lucy Dallas?
What, Stig Abel?
This is not just thrown together. Someone tweeted from Hawaii.
Brilliant.
The home of the Hawaiian pizza.
Well, it probably isn't, is it?
It almost certainly isn't. But we have a listener on the volcanic slopes of Kilauea, I want to say.
How wonderful.
Yeah, and other people. Jeffrey listens while he's crossing the US border, driving to youth centres in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico.
That's very Dylan-esque.
Yeah, and laudable.
And extremely laudable, absolutely.
Carrie listens from Ethiopia.
Brilliant.
And we've got a man and his wife in New York who tweeted to say their cat doesn't like Thea's dog.
But, I mean, how does he know?
Well, they understand everything, don't they?
Okay.
They don't really, I don't know. And finally, the magnificently named Walker Beecham, not on Twitter, so he emailed me to say he listens in his kitchen in Birmingham, Alabama. Y'all do nice work, he says. And he's called Walker Beecham, which I think couldn't be more of a Southern American name.
It's a wonderful name.
So
yeah.
Hello to him. Do keep him coming in your exotic or mundane locations when listening to us. Tweet at the TLS or do find any other way of getting in touch. We'll read it out. This week, we've got a Russian special in the paper, including an exclusive new ending to Camera Obscura, written by Vladimir Nabokov. Rachel Polonsky is writing about the life and novels of Vasily Grossman, and the question posed by Amy Knight is about the modern Russian state. Is it more sinned against than sinning? Our redoubtable Russian editor Rebecca Reich will talk us through it. Plus, Laura Freeman is in the studio to talk about one of Lucy's favourite subjects.
It's one of my subjects at the moment.
The
I don't
Durals.
Know about it. I mean, I'm not saying I don't like it.
No,
I very much do like it.
We're doing it because you like it
no,
so much. That's why we picked it.
I know, but yes it is. I'm just going to say yes.
And one of Thea's favourite subjects, food. Would the Durrells have liked pineapple on pizza, Lucy?
I'd say not. They were people of taste and discernment, mostly. Mind you, we are going to hear about pond life sandwiches.
So they've probably got a broad taste, which might include fruit and pizza.
It might.
I guess we'll never know for sure.
Keen listeners to the podcast will remember that a couple of weeks ago, Catherine Morris of this parish told us a lovely story about her sister meeting Dr. Stephanides from Gerald Durrell's much-loved trilogy about his family life on Corfu. Keen TV watchers will know the series inspired by the book that's been running for years now on the BBC, Delightful, Relaxing Sunday Night Telly.
Who wants that?
Which Stig doesn't like.
No, I don't dislike the show. I've never seen
this
the show.
This is my introduction, by the way.
Okay, you're fine.
Welcome, yeah. Stig.
Hello. No, I mean, do we like relaxing Sunday afternoon TV?
Yes.
Evening TV?
Not all of it. But when it's good, we do like it, don't we, Laura? I'm going to introduce Laura in a minute, but I've been hijacked.
Fine, carry on.
So now there is a book of stories and recipes from the Durrell matriarch, Louisa, which has been written by David Shimwell, and Laura Freeman wrote about it for the TLS and is here in the studio to discuss it with us. Yeah. Hello, Laura.
As we
Hello.
Know.
Thank you for joining us. So we've established that you do like Sunday Night Telly.
Oh, yes, I'd much rather watch The Durrells than Killing Eve. But
yeah. That's interesting. Have you seen the second series of Killing Eve? Anyway.
No, I do think it makes a difference when it's on in the week as well. This is an entirely different podcast, which we could get to later.
I thought Killing Eve was, even the first series, was slightly overrated. I thought it was all right, but everyone sort of falls over and pretends it's the greatest thing ever written, and that didn't strike me as that.
I only saw about 7 minutes of it.
Laura?
I gave up after two episodes.
Did you?
And I thought if it was two men, we would denounce it as horrible and violent and vicious.
I think it's the thing about... You know, also that thing about assassins, they're not real, are they? I mean...
There's lots of things on television that aren't real. I hate to break this to you.
I know it's fictional, but this sort of obsession with kind of people that go around... Should we be talking about the thing we're supposed to be talking about?
We do need to be onto that, but I would say this, that it's basic genre fiction, which I read a lot of, and just because it was originally written by a man anyway, just because it's been adapted by a woman and it features women, it still is just basic genre fiction. To roll over and pretend any otherwise seems to me to be wrong, but there you go.
Anyway, look.
We're not talking about that.
Let's talk about The Durrells. So I want to ask Laura, can you tell us what sort of book Dining with the Durrells is?
It's a little bit of a hodgepodge. It's
love that word.
A mix of Louisa Durrell's recipes, some of which are actually her grandmother's. She was born in India. And so they're actually mostly Indian recipes. So off they go to Corfu and they're eating onion bhajis and they're eating Taj Mahal titbits and Madras marbles. And then it's little extracts from the Gerald Durrell books, My Family and Other Animals, Birds, Beasts and Relatives and In the Garden of the Gods. And then some vignettes from Larry Durrell's books, also about Corfu.
Right, because we were just talking about Larry Durrell's books and whether we had
Larry,
read...
Is he Larry?
Oh,
Is he Larry in the book?
Yeah, in the it's very funny because in the Gerald Durrell books, he's Larry and he's kind of irascible and funny and annoying. And actually, I watched... I watched three of the TV series before going, oh, that's Lawrence Durrell.
Who wrote the Alexandra Quartet.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't famously thinking
difficult,
of him like
and
that.
It is a famously difficult quartet to finish.
It is.
Because it's almost, he's writing the tradition of Henry Millery.
He was
experimental,
friends with Henry Miller, I think,
and
wasn't he?
There's bits of sort of strange, sort of creepy sex.
There's quite a lot of sex, I think.
And the sort of the demi-monde he's really writing about. Yeah. And they both write about it. So I read Gerald Durrell. You read him as a child, don't you?
Yeah.
And then if you say, "Oh, I'll read Larry," I've seen him on
Larry
the,
and Jerry.
Yeah, Larry and Jerry. And then you'd be like, "Oh, that's a slightly different."
Yeah, don't give that one to your children. Is it a valuable addition to what we've called Durrelliana, do you think, or is it a spin-off?
I think Laura
from a
called
spin-off?
It Durrelliana.
Oh, you called it Durrelliana. Sorry. Yeah.
I think it's not wholly successful. I think it could have been a more beautiful book because I think if you'd had gorgeous photos of Corfu and the various villas they stayed in, I think it would be a lovely kind of leafing through on a Sunday night to fill the void that has been left by the ending of the Durrell sort of book. But it's slightly meanly produced. But the extracts remain extremely lovely and evocative. And I think if you're fond of them, then it's very nice to spend a couple of hours in their company.
Mm. Who is fond of... I mean, what audience is this aiming at? Is it the TV show audience squarely? I mean, reading it, do you think, oh, this is a, I don't want to say cash in, this is a
tribute.
Yeah, spin off, a tribute to, a homage to.
Yeah.
Does it feel like that?
Yeah, it does. I think it's written with great affection. And actually, David Shimwell is a botanist and he is quite interesting about some of the natural herbs and foraging that you can do on Corfu. And I love the idea that instead of just having a bog standard spanakopita with spinach, you can have one which is called a hortopitakia, which has fennel, chicory, dandelion, and spring onions. And I made one but with nettles and it actually came off pretty well.
Did you?
Yeah. Did you?
Yeah.
Nettle.
Wow.
I quite like it. Yeah.
You're supposed to be able to make, you can make soup, can't you?
Yeah.
And nettle greens. Tea. I've had nettle tea before.
But young ones, you want. I mean, I think it's getting a bit late in the season now to do it.
Is there a nettle season?
There is a nettle season.
Well, because they get big and tough and
stringy.
But by pouring boiling water on, you remove the sting, don't you?
Exactly.
There we go. People say they don't learn anything on this podcast.
And
this
I hope they don't.
No, I hope they don't.
They're learning a different sort of thing this time.
Yeah.
And I was surprised because... Well, you say that a lot of the recipes are Indian, as you say, a lot of curries, because she grew up there. But I remember in the book, there's lots of completely luscious descriptions of her making very English things like scones and biscuits that you wouldn't have thought that she would be, that you wouldn't have thought the climate or the ingredients would be suited to them. Is there any of that or not?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there are things like very classic seed cakes. But what's so nice is I think the mix of culture. So you do get Indian dishes and you get endless curries and then you get sort of English biscuity type things and then you get, you know, classic Greek dishes. And I was thinking, my partner came back from cricket on Sunday saying, I've just had the best cricket tea of my life. And it was the Indian wife of one of the players who had made a kind of amazing sort of mix of custard creams and spiced lamb patties and samosas and egg and cress sandwiches. And it went down a treat.
That's something
that sounds nice.
But that's cricket as well. We're in the realm of nostalgia here, aren't we? With this series and presumably this book. This is kind of the sunlight falling on the village green and hodgepodge of cold cultures coming together, better not think too critically about it, but actually on the face of it quite nicely.
But actually they were very open. The Durrells as a family seem to have been very open to other cultures. There was no problem. They weren't English. They didn't like that kind of narrow Englishness, did they? They didn't like that definition.
I thought what I found really fascinating is Louisa is not English. She was born in India, and I think even her grandmother had been born in India. India had been home for three generations. So when they talk of home and when her husband dies and she goes back to first Dulwich and then Bournemouth, England is not a country she knows. It's completely unfamiliar. So when they take this supposed great leap into the unknown going to Corfu, it's actually not so very strange, because going back to England, I think, was the real culture shock.
And which they didn't like, and everyone was kind of depressed and damp. And
well, you have a day like yesterday, and you know, can you
what
blame
What sort
them?
Of time is this? Is this the 30s, the 50s?
Well, 20s and 30s.
30s. Yeah. I've just read Mary Renault, The King Must Die, and she won a prize in 1947 for one of her books, which was 150 grand. She won an MGM prize, and she just looked around at the British winter and sort of the post-war winter, and I imagine the 20s and 30s winters are the same thing. This country that's cold and damp, and the food is bland and boring and watery. And must have been this urge to just find sunshine and sunlight and excitement somewhere else.
I think one of the things that really, really strikes you about the book is I think the ripeness of everything. So Jerry is always describing sun-warmed grapes and figs that are spitting at the seams and melons that are kind of, you know, collapsing in your hands because they're so lush and you're kind of stained with juice. And I think all of that is very, very heady and very appealing.
Do we think Louisa is one of the great mums? You were saying that, Lisa.
I've got a half-baked theory about, especially in children's literature, about great kind of mother figures. And I think she's one of them, that she's full of love and she's very tolerant and a great provider. And I was trying to think of two or three more, but not that many, maybe because if you have a wonderful mother figure like that, you don't want to go and do risk and drama and, you know, adventures.
So who are the good mum? The woman in The Darling Buds of May?
Ma Larkin.
Yes, actually
that's
she'd be one.
That's a classic mum, bounteous mum figure.
Moomin Mama. I'm sorry, we are talking about children's literature.
I think
she's
Mrs.
classic.
Weasley in Harry Potter is...
Yes, actually, yes.
Absolutely
she's
spot
a, she's
on.
She's a classic one, isn't she? Right. And I thought maybe Marmee from Little Women.
Oh, yeah.
She's a bit more distant, but still that kind of figure.
I interviewed a children's author once, and she said that you effectively need orphaned children or to create an artificial orphaned setup. So the parents are either dead or they're removed or the kids have been sent away. Because if you have the parents, loving parents there, effectively every adventure hits a full stop pretty quickly. So they go home
exactly.
And everything's all right.
I think that's why we couldn't think of too many because...
Well, The Mother and Swallows and Amazons is rather brilliant because she sort of makes the decision, yes, you can go off to this island. I will provide you with a fabulous, you know, hamper and don't drown. I think that's sort of ideal mother, isn't it?
Yeah. Good luck.
Bye-bye, darling.
I want to ask you a question, though, because you know better than most of this. I was trying to think, if you could attend one meal, you've virtually written a whole book about it, which I'm conscious of.
So tricky.
It doesn't have to be any one, but what immediately occurs, because I only just thought it's now, so I've not got anything planned myself, and Lucy, you can think about it. A meal in literature, which has got the juices flowing when you think about it that you'd like to attend?
I've always really liked in the Box of Delights when our hero is ill and he's in bed and he's bought a hot posset.
The egg posset.
Do you not want to be tucked up in bed and brought
no,
a hot
I don't.
Posset?
This is in the TV version as well. I can remember the guy. It's an egg. They take them. What do they do?
It's an egg and it's a tiny bit of whiskey. I think it's a bit of milk and it's all warmed together and it's served in
nice.
A big pudding basin. And do you not just feel cosseted already?
Yeah. I don't think you get
lovely.
Possets anymore. Do you? I bet that feels very Victorian. It's very Victoriana, isn't it? I was thinking... The meals they have in Fiesta, or The Sun Also Rises, the booze is outlandish.
It's industrial in quantities.
But the food that they have at one point they have a trout stew and fresh strawberries, which is very nice. And then they have one meal in Spain, and there's a reference. The narrator says, and because it was in Spain, there were a few extra courses, so we had to drink 5 bottles of wine to wash it down.
I love the had to.
We had to.
Yeah. And you think, 5 bottles of wine? One of the great things I'm fascinated by, which I still haven't had an answer to, I'm trying to get someone to write this. Maybe you might know this, Laura. In the history of humanity, you've heard me say this before, everyone will have been drunk the whole time. Because if you go basically from the Victorian period and before that, water wasn't safe. So you got up in the morning, you drank beer, or if you were rich, you drank claret or you drank port. In the Elizabethan times, you were again drinking beer. There was a famous Italian courtier wrote to someone, said, if you come to England, you cannot drink the water. Do not drink the water. You have to drink wine or beer. Which then made me think, well, hang on a second. Does that mean that throughout all of civilized human history, people were drinking, you know, 5 bottles of wine a day? Why were they not just drunk?
Well, you do hear people talk of small beer and weak beer, yeah. And I don't think it's beer as we know it.
But it's still got alcohol in it.
It might be like ginger beer, like just got a little bit of alcohol.
I think, though, it's still like, if you drank only 2% beer all day and that was the only thing...
We could try it.
You wouldn't be sober. I'm just fascinated by the fact that almost everything that will have happened in history will have been undertaken by drunk people. Why hasn't everyone ever explored
this
before?
But maybe that's why we're doing so very well now, because our water is drinkable and we're governing everything perfectly.
Lucy, I see the point you're making. I want someone to write. That'd be interesting to know. Were people drunk throughout history? Because they couldn't drink water.
As a teetotaler, I am not the person to write this.
you're good on food. What other food is in this book before we go?
Tell us
some highlights.
Can I read you Jerry's breakfast? Because I think if you're tired of your cornflakes.
Yes.
He talks of the toast and honeycomb and spreading out the musky brown gold delicacy on your bread, which was like spreading out liquid amber in which you might find almost anything from tiny moths and caterpillars to beetles and small centipedes. Once, to my delight, I found a species of earwig that was unknown to me.
What a life.
That's very him, though, isn't it? To be delighted by the earwig in his honey rather than going, ugh.
And he's very enterprising because he makes a sort of contract with the man who makes the best ice cream in Corfu. And he says, I went 3 times a week and I collected all the cockroaches from his kitchen. And in return, I could eat as much ice cream as I could manage.
That's a deal, isn't it?
Well, and the cockroaches were to feed his pets, weren't they?
Yeah.
So it was good. It was a very good deal for him.
I thought of another bit of food I'd like. This is, do you remember the James Herriot books? You know, the vet books. Mm. That it shouldn't happen to a vet. Yes. You're too young for this, Laura, I think. But I remember vividly, he goes on a boat and he gets hors d'oeuvres. And it's like pickled herring and stuff like that. And I was about 10 and I said to my mum, I want hors d'oeuvres. Can you make me some hors d'oeuvres?
And you came home from school. What's for tea? Is it hors d'oeuvres?
And she was like, what do you mean? I was like, I want hors d'oeuvres. James Herriot had hors d'oeuvres. And I think she made me them. I think it was like sliced bits of pepper and some mackerel. I don't know why there were hors d'oeuvres, but it was a thing in this book that he had hot, kind of nice... Yeah.
So that's very, sophisticated
of you hors d'oeuvres.
To have that for your tea.
Hang on, as Lucy told us, her ideal fantasy literary meal.
Yeah, good point, Laura.
Good point. No, does it have to be fictional?
Yeah, well...
Does it?
Well,
no.
Whatever's easier.
Well, it's just that there is a dinner that I would really, really, really like to have been at, which is in Paris in...
Of course.
I remember the date. I think it's before the First World War. I think it's about 1912. And Picasso and loads of other artists are living in the Bateau Lavoir in sort of semi-squalor, and they have a party for a painter called Rousseau, who they called Le Douanier Rousseau, who they kind of sort of semi-rediscovered. I can't remember why they had the party, but there's a sort of account of it.
The customs person.
Yeah, because he looked like a customs official rather than looking like a kind of exciting artist.
I enjoyed the way you left that untranslated, by the way. It's very,
I just assumed that everyone knew.
Yeah, very chic of you. My GCSE French brain was saying douanier. Anyway, go on.
And there's an account of it. And in fact, I think what happened, they ordered in some food from a local place, which didn't turn up. And so they all just got hammered because they... And somebody, I think Marie Laurencin made something, but basically the food didn't turn up, so they all got really hammered. But it was supposed to be this wonderful... And right. They all gave toasts to Douanier Rousseau. And it was kind of everybody who was cool in Paris at that point, which was, you know, almost the... Just everybody who was cool, full stop.
Yeah. So your favourite, just to be absolutely clear, your favourite fictional meal, you've gone for a real booze-up which had no food.
It would have had excellent food. The food they would have had sounded delicious. It doesn't work.
I think we might call this out to the listeners. Do because Thea will be back next week. Thea is, of course, our great gourmet. So anyone want to share with us their favourite meals in literature that they wish to have eaten themselves? There's the picnic, which you've written about in Wind in the Willows, where Ratty gradually speeds up and talks about crisps and...
Oh, completely breathless. He lists everything in the hamper
I can still think of, and I remember feeling hungry about. So people do tweet us, tweet at the TLS, at the TLS. Let us know which ones we're thinking. We'll try and give one to Lucy,
who's managed to not think of something which is not fictional and not food. Can I ask Laura one final thing?
Yes.
Can you please tell us what pond life sandwiches are?
I can indeed. Let me get this right. So pond life sandwiches, they are the Greek doctor's suggestion of what you can eat because they're full of protein. They are sort of little tiny plankton and shrimp and microorganisms in the water. Very proteinous, very meaty. And you just slap them between two slices of bread and delicious.
Wow. Delicious. You heard it here first.
Do we think delicious?
I'm taking it on Jerry's advice.
They'd be very damp, wouldn't they?
Maybe you could sort of sieve them and strain them through a muslin cloth or something.
Laura Freeman on that pond-based bombshell. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
To Russia, then. The paper begins with the resurrection of a discarded ending to Camera Obscura by Nabokov, which has been transcribed and translated for the first time by Olga Voronina. I'm pleased to say that it still sparks the telltale tingle between the shoulder blades of true Nabokovian writing. In the more familiar version of the novel, translated into English as Laughter in the Dark, the blind fine art expert Bruno Kretschmar dies at the hand of his mistress. He sat on the floor with bowed head, then bent slowly forward and fell, like a big soft doll, to one side. In the newly discovered conclusion, dating from 1931, he gets to take violent revenge, shooting Magda at close range, and then grimly palpating the corpse. Beneath his palms, all was wet and warm. Her smooth stomach, breasts, and especially her face were like some kind of porridge. Which is pretty grim. There's also the opportunity to discover or rediscover another Russian great this week. Rachel Polonsky has reviewed Vasily Grossman's reassembled Stalingrad, together with an account of his life and creative evolution. The novel, actually two novels welded together, covering a single year between 1942 and 1943, was designed to show the Soviet victory over German fascism. Plus, Amy Knight reviews two books which ask opposing questions. Is the West unjustifiably Russophobic, ascribing evils to a nation that is willfully misunderstood, or does Russia simply represent a grave threat to Western democracies, making it more than worthy of our sceptical ire? Well, to answer that and anything else Russian we can throw at her, we're joined by TLS Russian editor Rebecca Reich. Rebecca, hello.
Hi, Stick.
Firstly, I'm asking you this as well, Lucy. Are we all comfortable with how we're pronouncing the word Nabokov?
I'm comfortable in that I'm totally ignorant, so I'm going to bow to Rebecca on that
one. Rebecca, how do you pronounce Nabokov?
I would say Nabokov, but I don't mind how you pronounce it as long as people are reading it.
Do you know, actually, in 1960 he was asked about it, Rebecca. Have you seen this interview he gave?
No.
And they said to him, how do you pronounce it? And he did a very long Nabokovian answer. And he said, as to pronunciation, Frenchmen, of course, say Nabokov with the accent on the last syllable. Englishmen say Nabokov, accent on the first. And Italians say Nabokov, accent in the middle, as Russians also do, as you do, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Nabokov, a heavy open O, as in Knickerbocker. My New England ear is not offended by the long, elegant middle O of Nabokov, as delivered in American academies. So there you go. You can pronounce how you like. But he also says Vladimir rhymes with redeemer. So it's Vladimir.
Vladimir.
Vladimir. In the Russian pronunciation, yeah. Vladimir.
Vladimir. Yeah. So there you go. It sounds to me more or less, Rebecca, that you are a true Nabokovian and he doesn't really care either way. So let's talk about Nabokov. What's the background to this, Rebecca? Where did this come from? How exciting is it?
Well, I think it's very exciting. It's, as you said, it's his first attempt at ending his novel, Camera Obscura, which he wrote in Russian originally in 1931 and then translated by himself as Laughter in the Dark 7 years later. And people who know the book know that both versions, the Russian and the English version, end with the main character getting killed by his former lover. But what we've found out is that there was an earlier ending to the Russian version where things went quite differently for him. And Nabokov had the hero killing his lover instead of her killing him. And we know this because Olga Voronina, who's a Nabokov expert and teaches Russian literature at Bard College, she dug up this ending in the Nabokov archives in the Library of Congress on 9 holograph pages, and she transcribed it from the Russian and translated it for the first time. And so we're pretty excited to be able to publish that for the first time.
And what did you make of it? When I read it, it felt very Nabokovian. It felt like you knew what was going on. It felt like something that he would write. What did you think?
Well, I think it's pretty significant. It's much more than just a curiosity piece. It's it tells you a lot about Nabokov's way of writing, and this is something that Voronina points out in her introduction, where she says that you can learn a lot about his narrative ethics from how he what he did when he rewrote this ending. So in his later books, it's often a rule that murderers have no right to any kind of hope or redemption or even an afterlife. So here we actually can see Nabokov making a choice to go down that kind of ethical path in action when he first makes his hero a killer, but then changes his mind and turns him into a victim so that he can actually get that kind of redemption that he's seeking.
And even at the end of this one, although he shoots her, it sort of ends everything. I don't want to spoil this, but here is the ending. Everything was as before, dark, velvety dark, and someone's hands, many hands, grabbed him from all sides. So although he is the shooter, his fate isn't necessarily a good one either.
No, it's not a happy ending either way.
But I do think it is significant. It's very significant, that switch, isn't it? Because I don't know the book, but he goes off with the his mistress when she's 16, and kind of runs off with her and dumps his wife. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so for him then to also shoot her, I mean, of course he could do that. He could do whatever he wanted, but it's a very interesting switch that actually he has her kill him.
Yes.
What do we make
in the final version?
Yeah. What do we make of the bit I quoted? The beneath his palms, always wet and warm, a smooth stomach, breast, and especially a face with like some kind of porridge. That's deliberately distasteful, isn't it? In the way that's written.
Well, it's this very sensual, I think, Nabokovian language. But it's also a kind of almost, estrangement from her body, the body that he knows so well. But now he's blind by this point. And so he's only feeling her. He's not able to see her. So you actually get that kind of sense of touch that's really embedded into the writing. And Nabokov is able to convey that so well.
Have you read much of him in Russian, Rebecca?
I've read some of him in Russian.
Is he an easy Russian read?
I think he's an interesting Russian read to read alongside his English language self-translation, which he did a lot of. So he self-translated Laughter in the Dark. He self-translated his autobiography, Speak Memory.
I love that book.
Which I also love. And often he makes adjustments between the different versions that, you know, for different audiences, but also almost as if he feels the language differently in different languages. And so, you know, aspects of the words and the phrasing have to change too.
And that doesn't happen that often. I'm trying to think of other examples of big literary figures who self-translate. Beckett does a bit, doesn't he?
Beckett does, yeah. And that's, it's though quite, sometimes he, you know, he let other people translate him. But he does do that. And it's really interesting
when you
to see what he does as well. Yeah. I can't think of that many other people who do it, really.
No, it's just interesting that mid-century point these two great writers were doing. What's your favourite Nabokov? Is it Speak Memory?
Speak Memory is one of them. But I actually really love his little novel, Pnin.
Oh, yeah.
Which is often overlooked. Maybe because it's about a Russianist, which I can sympathize with.
Yeah.
You know, it's a novel about a Russian emigre who teaches Russian at a small liberal arts college on the East Coast, much like the ones where he himself taught. And he's this really wonderfully absent-minded professor character who's thoroughly displaced from everywhere, from his homeland, from his adopted country. And whenever I think of it, I always think of this scene where Pnin finds himself pressing the button of a water fountain for a particularly ungrateful squirrel who's sort of staring at him contemptuously and greedily drinking up the water and then leaves without thanking him at all. And Pnin's, of course, weeping the whole while. And it's just one of those really Nabokovian scenes that somehow managed to be incredibly sympathetic to their character, to the character, and also completely cruel at the same time.
Is it a metaphor for the academic experience as a teacher?
I really
we're
hope
all
not.
Pressing buttons for squirrels.
For squirrels, okay.
Ungrateful squirrels.
I always thought that if I could go to, I didn't go to many lectures when I was at university, but if I could go to a lecture series at any time in the history of universities, going to his Cornell lecture series classes in the 50s, I thought would just be a remarkable experience. And there's a collection, you can actually buy his lectures.
Read them,
I've read them, they're magnificent. But his exam questions.
Have you read those?
Yeah, I've read some
I've
of his
exams.
So one of his questions, well, this is an actual question by Nabokov. Discuss Flaubert's use of the word and.
Oh, he was kidding, wasn't he?
No, that's an actual...
No, but I bet he was also kidding and saying, well, if you can do it, you know,
but can you imagine,
I'll be impressed.
You've got Nabokov as your teacher, and then you sit down to the exam thing, and the first question is discuss Flaubert's use of the word and. You're not that tough an examiner, are you, Rebecca?
I hope not.
No. We better move on, because I can talk about Nabokov all day. Let's move on to Vasily Grossman and the novel Stalingrad, which is a sort of Soviet War and Peace, Rachel Polonsky explains. How significant is this novel, Rebecca? I hadn't heard a great deal about it, if I'm honest. How significant is the novel and is Grossman as a figure?
Well, as a novel, it's really significant. First of all, as the first half of this massive epic that people usually only know the second half of, and that's Life and Fate, which people often describe as the Soviet War and Peace because it's, you know, a massive epic novel. It's philosophical. It's a historical novel that takes place during war. It focuses on families and the relationship between individuals and history. But actually, in Soviet times, it was Stalingrad. It was this first half of this two-part epic that was described that way. And the state was actually actively looking for a kind of Soviet Tolstoy who would be able to express the spirit of the times and, you know, put it into a kind of the form of a novel. So it's significant on its own terms as a novel, but it's also really significant because of its publication history, which is interesting in itself. So he began it during the war.
He was at Stalingrad, wasn't he?
He was at Stalingrad, that's right. And so he began writing it in 1943, I believe, while he was still at Stalingrad. And then it was serialized in the Soviet Union before Stalin's death. So it was published before Stalin's death in 1952 and then republished over the course of the 1950s. But what happened to Life and Fate was quite different, because in 1960 he finished Life and Fate and he submitted it, and then it was rejected for publication, and then his apartment was famously raided and the manuscript was seized. But he was able to save a copy, which was then smuggled out well after his death in the 70s and published abroad. So these two halves had very different fates, and they also acquired really different reputations, one as a kind of very Soviet novel and one as an anti-Soviet novel. And that made the anti-Soviet novel quite popular in the West.
Yeah.
And gave him the reputation of a dissident writer. But Stalingrad is a much more kind of complicated situation, because it's really a novel that does praise the Soviet war effort, that praises Stalin, and that incorporates a lot of sort of socialist realist style. So that's one reason that the translator, Robert Chandler, and Elizabeth Chandler, that's one reason that Robert Chandler thinks that it was not, translated until now, and also given enough attention until now.
And it is extraordinary, that Fate in the West, because basically, lots and lots of people have heard of Life and Fate, and as far as I know, no one's heard of Stalingrad. But you can see that the anti-Soviet novel fitted the way people were thinking in the West at that time. But the first one, it wasn't just pro-Soviet, was it? It was anti-Nazi. It was about that war, that pivotal turning point in Stalingrad, and the extraordinary kind of, I don't know what the word is, the kind of extraordinary feat of the Russian soldiers holding the Nazis at bay.
Yeah.
And you absolutely wonder why the anti-Nazi novel wasn't popular.
The anti-Nazi novel, as in Stalingrad.
Exactly. I mean, not as it being not just pro-Soviet, but
in the West.
Look what we did. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it never made it to translation. I think people just the reputation that it had for being a sort of Stalin era, approved novel must have outweighed any other aspects that might have made it, sort of ideologically acceptable in the West.
Well, it's interesting we're talking about the Western reception of Russian ideas, because that does take us to another piece in the paper. Amy Knight's reviewed two books, Elliot Bornstein's Plots Against Russia and Mark Smith's The Russia Anxiety. And effectively, they make two diametrically opposed cases about the West's relationship with Russia, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a review that looks at an issue from two opposite tacks by looking at these two books that argue in different ways about essentially about kind of conspiracy theorizing and anxieties that Russia and the West have about each other.
And Elliot Bornstein's contention, which seems to me as a occasional observer of Russian activity in the West to be hard to sustain, is effectively there is Russophobia, and our view of how Russia conducts itself is conditioned by a sense of hostility on our part rather than hostility inherent in their own actions.
That's Mark Smith's contention.
Yeah. Okay.
So he's arguing that that the West thinks in conspiratorial terms about Russia, and it suffers from what he calls a Russia anxiety, but that's mainly because it doesn't understand Russia's history. And so he argues that if you tell history in a different way that highlights the positive aspects of Russian history a little bit more than they usually are in the West, then you're going to realize that not all Russian leaders were that terrible, even in the drive to modernization and even during policies like collectivization or the creation of the Gulag system, the Stalinist leadership believed that they were implementing socialism, and so that there are different ways of telling history, and that affects the narrative that comes out.
Amy Knight, it has to be said, would sympathize more with the Bornstein position then, which is not that.
Yeah, she does sympathize more with that, and that position is that he's looking at conspiratorial trends in Russian media and Russian film and fiction since the collapse of the Soviet Union that focus on conspiracy theories about the West. So things like CIA plots against Russia, the idea of Ukraine being a puppet of the West, the idea that there is gay propaganda coming in from the West. And he argues that it's partly a function of geopolitics, but also an expression of something that's like deeply emotional about how Russians see themselves since 1991. And he even calls it libidinal, this kind of urge to define themselves in opposition to the West.
It's funny how Russia in some ways is a sort of crucible of all these modern anxieties. I mean, even if you, whatever side of the argument you take, and it seems there seems to be a sensible one, but even if you take the opposite view, Russia becomes the sort of focus for all sorts of issues to do with conspiracy and demagoguery and undue influence online and how the truth can be reshaped, fake news. A lot of the things that are sort of slogans of the age tend to have a Russian angle at some point, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And there's a long history to that. You know, Russia and the West have loomed pretty large in each other's imagination for, you know, since the 19th century, at least. And we remember, some of us remember the Cold War tensions in which that continued through the 20th century. And this review really looks at how these this mutual sort of preoccupation and suspicion continues to the present day.
Well, Russia looms large in the TLS this week, thanks to you entirely, Rebecca. There's all sorts of other Russian aspects, but those bits we've talked about there are the main ones. And the Nabokov really is such a joy, I think, to have in the paper and to read. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Dick.
Do you have a favourite Nabokov, Lucy?
Well, I'm afraid I was going to say Speak Memory as well.
Oh, I like
Sorry,
Speak Memory.
We all saying Speak
Can we say
Memory.
Say Lolita? Am I allowed to say Lolita?
You're allowed to.
Do you find Lolita creepy?
It's weird how my attitude has changed. I do now, yeah.
When you were younger, was it all a bit racy and kind of...
Yeah, but I mean, I can see that his, you know, you're not on his side.
No.
We are supposed to think...
The greatest of all unreliable narrators
yeah,
is
yes,
Humber
exactly.
Humber.
Yeah, but he's so... The trouble is, he's so good.
That's the genius
that's
of the,
yeah, but
that's
a problem.
The book argument, isn't it?
It is, but it's probably... In a way that Speak Memory is beautiful and intense
yeah.
and evocative.
I've not read Lolita since having... children, and particularly having girl children, and I wonder whether actually I'd even be able to read it now in the way that I read it when I was 22.
I wonder because
the things do change. She also forget that she dies. She's dead at the start of the book, isn't she? There's the framing device as well. Did you know that when Nabokov first submitted to a publisher, he said, "We really like it. Thank you so much, but can you rewrite it so the action takes place on a Midwestern farm and it's about a rugged Western farmer having gay sex with a young boy?" It's full of deep philosophical musings like, God hates us, I guess we're all hated, and things like that. And that's,
really?
That's the letter he got back from a publisher.
Wow.
Love Lolita, Vladimir.
Could you write a different book?
But would you mind entirely rewriting it to make it a sort of Midwestern... isolated farm
wow.
story about...
Well, maybe they wanted to write that book.
Yeah, yeah, maybe they thought
how
it was American.
How about this? I've had an idea.
But,
gosh.
Nabokov decided not to, and mm-hmm. that's probably a good thing. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Rebecca Reich and Laura Freeman. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS, or we'll come and shout at you wherever you live in the world. We won't really do that, Lucy. Next week, one of my favourite editions and podcasts are recommendations for summer reads. Lucy, you'll
mm-hmm.
be back.
I will. Pretending to have read or to be looking for... No, genuinely looking forward to books.
You don't have to pretend because it's all in the future.
I never pretend anyway. It's all true.
And Thea's going to be back as well. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.